The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas and are looking forward to a successful new year. I am, and I welcome you to tonight's first Heretics Hour program for 2012. I have open phone lines in the second hour, as usual, but until then, I want to share what I think have been our successes in the past year, and what are the important themes for me anyway, going forward? What kind of a year will it be? Last year, when I opened my first program of 2011, I predicted a very powerful year. But powerful times are often seen as bad times. They feel that way. They can feel overwhelming and be overwhelming and feel like it's just too much. And I think we had that kind of a year in 2011, but much was accomplished, both for good and ill. You know, I'm a person who likes beginnings, so I'm always happy at the beginning of something. I'm happy at the beginning of a new year, and I'm always positive, and I like to plan, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? And everything looks possible, so I don't know how many of you are that way, but I'm glad that we have New Year's. I always like the new year, so enough of that, but I want to say that 2012 is an election year in the U.S., where most of you listening do live. And in election years, those in power try to keep everything as nice as possible for the voters. So nothing terrible will happen this year that would spark general outrage. However, the National Defense Authorization Act is a law that grants the U.S. military the legal right to conduct secret kidnappings of U.S. citizens, followed by indefinite detention, interrogation, torture, and even murder, was passed and by the lawmakers, and it was signed by our, quote, president, unquote. This is all conducted completely outside the protection of law, this right to conduct this right that the lawmakers have given the president, with no jury trial, no legal representation, and not even any requirement that the government produce evidence against the accused. In fact, no trial at all. Not a jury trial. No jury and no trial. But nothing will be done with it for a while, I don't think, because now they'll hope that the citizens will just forget about it while they continue to throw threats of terrorism in our faces. And we feel fear of that rather than of our own government. So someday that will come back to haunt us, but not right at the moment, probably. That's the danger, really, that we take, that we have, is that when we take this state of affairs as normal, we fall back into thinking that we're living in some kind of normal times, and things look peaceful enough, things look normal enough, and we don't then have to do anything right away. We have time. What's important, I think, is that we stay vigilant and that we realize that we are living in very dangerous times and that we see it that way and, we don't get complacent. However, I said in, of my program a year ago, my opening of 2011, that I thought there would be some breaches in the wall in last year, in the coming year, which is 2011. And I think there were. I think Israel has lost a lot of credibility in 2011. seems that Wall Street is people understand that Wall Street is run by Jews who are robbing the United States citizens or taxpayers. And this has become a commonly heard refrain. The position of Germany in World War II has, I think, became even better understood last year. And that is due to a lot of people who are talking about it very openly and putting forth a great deal more truth, and people are recognizing it. And it's mostly, it's not so much that people don't know these things, is that they think they're not to be talked about, or they're afraid to talk, be the first one to talk about it. So once it starts being talked about, then everybody, not everybody, a lot of people chime in and say, that's right, that's right. So we have a lot of that going for us. And finally, most important to me, great strides were made in Holocaust revisionism. Now, I'll go into that first. And I want to say that, remind you all that Sylvia Stoltz was released from prison last year. That happened in mid-year, and it was hailed and celebrated. We haven't heard too much from Sylvia since then, but at least she's out, and of course she's not free to say much, but that was a kind of a big thing that happened. Also, some new books were released. One is The Gas Vans, A Critical Evaluation by two authors, Alvarez and Marais. And also Sobibor, and a second book, Chelmno, by the authors Carl Mutonio, Jürgen Graf, and Thomas Kues. Actually, Chelmno is just by Mutonio. But these were new books in 2011, and I discussed the first one on two of my radio programs. I also raised $5,000 for these three writers to transfer their microfilm that has been held in Russian hands, was finally released when Soviet Union collapsed around that time, that all these records about the Einsatzgruppen that were held by the Russians or that they dreamed up, that they wrote up, that they created. Anyway, there's scads of it, and they are going to transfer this onto CDs to eventually write the first comprehensive book on the Einsatzgruppen. And I think that was a great accomplishment that our people came up with the money. Now, I have written quite a bit about Dennis Avey. I don't know how many of you recall him, but his book, The Man Who Broke into Auschwitz, came out in 2011. And I wrote several research articles about this hoaxer. He's a British ex-POW, beginning in 2010. And I went on into spring 2011. I wrote about five or six. Four of them were major articles. So I also did two Heretics Hour shows last year on this man. No, this one was in 2009, but 2010, I mean, but the second one was in June 27th of last year, if you're interested in going back and listening to it. Anyway, my work on Avey shed light on the entire corrupt Holocaust industry, including the way he was aided and abetted by the BBC and by the British Labour Party and by the very influential Holocaust Educational Trust, which is an organization of British Jews, very powerful. And you can find all these articles on my website, carolynyeager.net, under my articles on the right side menu, and also at revisionist blog at revblog.codo.com. Now, I bring this up because I just found something very interesting today on him, and so I'm saying more about him than I would have. I stopped following Avey after I finished those because I had other things to look into. But just today, I was looking up his book sales to see if he had good sales or if they had fallen. And I found something very important that I had missed, a new article by Guy Walters, dated November 17th, 2011. And this is after my articles had been out and passed around for about 6 months. And he, although he had written an article about exposing Avey's book, or Avey's testimonies, before I wrote my articles, I think, because that's when where I first got inspired, learned about it. So he has been this new article that he just came out with. He's only wrote that one, and now he's that was a couple years ago, and now he's come out with this. Avi's, it's titled, he's calling for Avi's Holocaust memoir to be withdrawn from publication. That's pretty strong. Anyway, Guy Walters, you know, is a British writer. Dennis Avi is a British ex-POW from World War II. And this is all big in Britain. It doesn't come across over here so much. This Guy Walters also wrote a book, which many of you are probably familiar with or read about, revealing Simon Wiesenthal to be a liar. And I forgot to look up remind myself of the name of that book. But anyway, it's he lied about just about everything. But see, Simon Wiesenthal is still, it hasn't brought him down to have all that revealed about him. This is what's so difficult. But anyway, after detailing how Avi's book differs radically from what he said in an interview he had given to the Imperial War Museum in July 2001, Guy Walters came to these conclusions. And let me repeat that this article he wrote is based on basically the fact that Walters looked up this interview that Avi had given to the British Imperial War Museum in 2001 about his experiences at Auschwitz as a POW. And they are quite different from, since he did that, he worked on his writing a book and worked on his interviews he was having with other people. And he changed his story quite a bit by the time he was getting more and more famous. He wasn't famous at all in 2001. So his book came out last year, but he started being written about at the end of 2009 in the newspapers and mostly in 2010. So Walters wrote this. This is part of his article. I'm going to quote it. There are four bodies that need urgently to address the problem with Avi's story. First, he means four groups. First, there is Hodder and Stoughton, the publisher, which told the Sunday Times in the past, "We had no reason to doubt Mr. Avi's account at the time of publication, and we have no reason to doubt it now. The paperback of Avi's book is currently second in the Sunday Times nonfiction chart." Well, that's Walter's claim. So in Britain, the paperback is second in the nonfiction chart. So his sales are still going, although I will say that they, right when the hardback book came out, they were selling it, and he was in bookstores promoting it, and they had put a price of £4 on it, €4 maybe it was €4, the book was supposed to be it's supposed to sell for like $25 or $28, something like that, but they keep putting it on sale in order, as I wrote about, in order to cause more people to buy it because it's cheap, and then they can show what a bestseller it is. But in any event, the British people want to make him a hero because he's British and he stood up to these Germans and so on in his the way he puts it in his silly book. But this idea that the Hodder and Stoughton said we had no reason to doubt Mr. Avi's account at the time of publication, of course it's a lie. They were told ahead of time, and Walter's story came out, but and then they say we have no reason to doubt it now. That's just talk. And as a matter of fact, this is the same thing Boston University President Robert Brown said replied to me when I wrote him a letter explaining why Elie Wiesel was a fraud. You know, Elie Wiesel is employed at Boston University as a teacher of philosophy and religion, and he said the same thing. He said to all the stuff that I sent him, he just said, I have no reason to doubt Mr. Wiesel's account of his wartime activities, and I'm sure he is an honest and man who people can trust, you know, something like that. Anyway, second, there is a Holocaust. This is Walters again. He said, first, it's the publisher has to address this problem with AV's story. Second, there is the Holocaust Educational Trust, which has embraced AV and promoted him. Very true. It is largely thanks to HET that the third body in question, the British government, and mainly the Labour government, but they all go along with it, awarded AV a British Hero of the Holocaust Medal, an award the HET campaigned to be established. He says the fourth organization that needs to ask questions is the BBC, whose employee, Rob Broomby, is the co-author of AV's book. Yes, this is very interesting. Rob Broomby of the BBC was right in there from the beginning working with AV, and he certainly knows all the secrets and how it's changed, and he knows where all the skeletons are. So he's quite culpable, too. Walter says the broadcaster has been generous, meaning BBC, in giving airtime to what is essentially a commercial enterprise. This is so true. This book is a book for profit. It's published by a publisher. You know, I mean, he wants to sell his book. And the BBC has just given all kinds of time and energy and space, both print space and airspace and radio and TV, television type space to this guy, Dennis Abey, promoting him. Furthermore, Walter says, Broomby has serious questions to answer. At what point during the writing of The Man Who Broke Into Auschwitz did he become aware that some of his co-author's claims were problematic? Well, I think that's interesting because, as he says, he calls it problematic. See, he has to be diplomatic. He has to be careful how he writes this because he's writing in mainstream publications. So he calls the co-author's claims, AV's claims problematic, when actually the right word would be lies. His claims are lies. But, okay, continuing with Walters, there are numerous other problems with AV's book, and not just those concerning his time as a POW. However, the passages regarding the Holocaust are what have propelled the book to the top of the charts, and it is these claims that have led to AV being both feted and honored. Continuing, given that the account of AV's story about breaking into Auschwitz as published in this book varies in such a fundamental and disquieting way from his earlier telling to the Imperial War Museum, the book should be withdrawn from circulation and its claims presented to an independent body of historians for assessment. His last paragraph is, Duns, Wheel, and I. Now, he mentioned these in the beginning of the article. These are two men who have worked with him on this expose and looking into and searching into the facts about AV as they've changed over the years. So he says that Duns, Wheel, and I asked Hodder and Staunton to do this 7 months ago. The firm can no longer afford to be an ostrich. In order to protect its reputation, it must realize that telling such questionable stories about the Holocaust is a distasteful business. Well, this sounds like Walters, a British journalist, is serious about this. He's the only one who's doing this, and I have to say it speaks well for him. And he ought to be supported. There are a lot of comments to this article, which I did not have time to read. But I saw that he answered a couple people, and later I will go back to that and see what all that's about and what he said. But this is the same thing. I mentioned the Boston University and the president that I wrote to above earlier, and this is the same thing that should be done to them. But, that they need to answer for the fact that they are protecting this Elie Wiesel and have him in their school, and when there's so many questions surrounding him and it's shown that he's lied. But I'm not Guy Walters, they certainly don't need to listen to me, but there's nobody else who's speaking up about this. that has a reputation. But anyway, if someone like Walters would go after Elie Wiesel, well, that would be great. That would really be great. But Elie Wiesel's a lot bigger target than Dennis Avey, who's kind of a nobody. But still, he's got the British government behind him. So Holocaust revisionism, my point here, continues to be a strong theme for white people. There are those who say, who have said, that it's not something we should spend much time on anymore. It's not going to get us anywhere. I totally disagree, naturally. We are making progress, and it is white people who are blamed for the fake Jewish Holocaust. All white people, not just Germans. Although the British are still playing it up as a solely German phenomenon, and the American media too, but not the Jews. Jews like Elie Wiesel and Deborah Lipstadt and others are increasingly blaming all Europeans. Now, another theme that is dear to my heart, but I'm convinced it's absolutely essential for white survival also and progress for us, is World War II revisionism. In 2011, I did 5 programs about the Morgenthau Plan for Germany devised during World War II and about who ran the Nuremberg Allied military tribunals and why. I did 6 programs on white culture, especially culture in the Third Reich. I did 4 programs debunking lies and myths about Adolf Hitler and other National Socialists. Now, this year, I'm going to concentrate on what was done to Germany during this war, an actual Holocaust, if you will, far worse than anything the Jews went through. I'm going to begin that tonight in the second hour of the program. I have been reading the book The Fire by Jörg Friedrich, and that's going to be my starting point. So I'll go on from here and get back to this in the second hour. So number 3 of what I think is an important theme for 2012 is debt, of course, and the now universal distrust of bankers and the entire banking Wall Street establishment. The breakup of the Eurozone comes in with that also, and that's big news for us, if it should happen, if it should happen. I did 3 programs in 2011 about economics, and that's not really my, you know, my theme for my program. But I did it because you just can't get away from the importance of it. Mainly European, the European Eurozone problems, but also United States. And I follow this kind of news with great interest. And tonight I want to mention 2 articles that I saw last week. Germany's finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, was quoted, "We have to tackle the actual causes of the crisis, overly high debts and lack of competitiveness." Well, I say, overly high debts and lack of competitiveness are caused by the people who you're dealing with. How are you going to tackle the people themselves? How are the Germans or the French, say, going to tackle that? This is inherent in the people that are that tend to create overly high debts and fail to be competitive. And you can't change the people who make up the country. I'm talking about countries such as Greece or Spain or even Italy. I'm not condemning these people. I'm not trying to put down these people. I'm saying they have a different enough culture that they're not competitive on the same level with Germans, Dutch, Swedes, etc., whoever you want to make out there. That's a pipe dream of globalists that they've sold us, and the European Union is trying to sell that they can make everybody follow the same rules and make it all work. Now, Schäuble, I think it's pronounced, said he sees no sign of a credit crunch in Germany. Asked about other countries, he pointed to the ECB's, European Central Bank's, moves to provide massive long-term loans to banks. Given the measures the ECB has taken to provide banks with liquidity, he said, it's hard to imagine that banks would not be in a position to provide sufficient loans to business. Well, You see, it's not about loans. It's not about liquidity. You can create all the liquidity you want. It's about the people. And, you know, if you can't, you can't change the people. Now, I'm going to make a comment here, and I'm not being arrogant. That's not the purpose of what I'm saying. I'm making a comparison about people and freedom of people to be the way they want to be. But if you put Germans in charge of all education in Greece, say, and they also fill all the government positions and run the media, that is, run the country, and what the people hear and see and learn about, then in time, you might change the thinking and behavior of Greeks somewhat. But that's not self-determination, is it? The bottom line is you can't make other people behave the way you want them to. That's why we have nations, and that's why we should keep them and not have a common currency. All right, another article that I want to comment on real quick is from Bill Bonner. He talked about an exclusive survey showing chief executive pay, this is back in the U.S. now, has roared back after 2 years of stagnation and decline. Pay hikes of between 27 and 40% in 2011. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're come to our first half hour break, and we'll be having fun.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Grim prospects are ahead for Europe's single currency in the new year as the region's leaders warn of tough sacrifices in this most severe test in decades. 2012 marks 10 years since Europeans first held euro notes and coins in their hands. But with recession looming, the sense of optimism that greeted the United currency at its inception seems to have evaporated, as Artista Sarsilia now reports.
The birth of an ambitious project, a common currency, celebrated with no less than a big bang.
The euro is the beginning of a strong European Union. We shall be the best in the world. The best in the world.
Yet 10 years down the road, the euro is not in the best of shape. A spiraling sovereign debt crisis, credit downgrades, rising interest rates, tens of millions unemployed, budget cuts, and violent protests.
The euro is undergoing the worst crisis it has ever been in. And obviously the founders of the euro did not hope that this would happen.
For what began as a step towards a united Europe has become a race against time, with EU leaders scrambling to keep it together. Euroskeptics have long argued that the euro was flawed from the start, pursuing a political dream above all else. Well, they say lumping together polar opposite economies like that of Greece and Germany into a monetary union could never work.
All economic rationality has been thrown out of the window in the pursuit of this goal, and we're now reaping the consequences of it.
Couple that with internal squabbles and deadlocks.
There has to be a sign from somewhere that some economic entity that is credible is going to back every Eurozone bond. And there are only two or three entities that can do that. One is the European Central Bank. The other is basically the German government. And neither of them right now are willing to do it.
Now, this exhibit shows the journey of the European Union and the creation of the single currency, with documented events in history that explain why it would have been appealing to decision makers at the time, so much so that cracks in the fundamentals may have been overlooked or ignored, which brings us to this point. 10 years after the creation of the euro, its appeal has waned, and despite last-ditch efforts to save it, its future is still uncertain. In the spirit of the new year, we asked for some predictions.
What one can be sure of is that this crisis is going to be a long and bumpy road. However, if you would ask me, do you think that the euro would still exist in 10 years' time, my answer would be yes.
They can't bring themselves to admit that it was a mistake. And so I'm afraid we risk the very thing they purport to fear, which...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am going to continue with my discussion of what I think are the important themes for 2012 for are white people. And I was talking about this article by Bill Bonner, who is a financial writer. And he was, I had just said that the chief executive pay has roared back last year after 2 years of stagnation, with pay hikes between 27% and 40%. And he also says that the latest government figures show wages for the majority of Americans are failing to keep up with inflation. Now, he tells us that in this survey, three of the year's top 10 earners come from the healthcare industry. He doesn't think much of the healthcare industry, and neither do I. The top earner, it turns out, was John Hammergren at McKesson, the world's largest healthcare firm. He made $145 million last year, most of it from stock options. Well, the way this worked was that we had a couple of years, we had a downturn, and then now that the stock market has come back, and these people, these men, if they decide to retire at this point, they make a lot of profit on the stock that they own, which they're able to unload at this price. They're able to take advantage of it because they have these options. So, Bonner says 2010 was a great year to lose your job as a CEO. I wonder if I've got that right. I think means 2011. Four of the 10 highest paid CEOs were retired or departing executives. Ronald Williams, former head of Aetna, a health insurer, exercised 2.4 million options for a profit of $50 million. Aetna's stock price declined by 70% when he after he assumed the role of CEO in February 2006 until his retirement. And so it declined, but then I guess it's come back some, and he sells out, even though he didn't do a good job for the company. Now, although it might not have been his fault, it's the economy, but at pharmacy chain CVS, and we have CVS in Texas, Thomas Ryan made a $28 million profit on his options. During his 13-year tenure as CEO, the stock price decreased 54%, but that didn't hurt what he made. Omnicare's Joel Gamunder retired last August and received cash severance of $16 million, part of a final year pay package worth $98 million. Well, I'm not into attacking people who make money. But this is just examples of the kind of system we have gotten stuck in, and how wrong it has to be. Bonner says the system is rigged. The Fed's rigged it. They turned America's leading business sectors into zombie-controlled, value-destroying industries. They turned the nation's money into an ersatz currency, which is a fake substitute for money. And they push the country's middle-class households in debt holes they find it difficult to climb out of. And then, he says, when the whole degenerate system was ready to come crashing down, which he thought it should have, They bailed out the debt mongers and propped up the whole corrupt system with $29 trillion in money that didn't belong to them. He says a merry little depression would have been so much better. Well, there's nothing wrong with depressions, but the fact is, this is a very corrupt system, but I don't think that we want a revolutionary bunch of street people taking it over either. So this is something that's has to be discussed quite a bit. I don't know what the white solution to this is, really. Now, my fourth theme is, and one of my favorites, too, is the attacks against the political right and the immigration problem. This is ongoing since 1940 or thereabouts, the attacks against the political right. And I'm just going to talk about Germany tonight because the way the government and media have played up, possibly created, the alleged Zwickau neo-Nazi terror cell, which I've talked about in the past, is quite instructive for us, no matter where we are. And it's a story of how the entire neo-Nazi scene is nothing but an intelligence operation. In Der Spiegel of December 19th, one of the most recent articles about this whole Zwickau terror cell, I mean, you know, what I want to say is they are building this up into something that is, if you have any understanding of it, I mean, it's just totally crazy what they're building this up into, this huge national crisis of terrorists in Germany that based on these three people that they can't even prove anything, that they did anything. Now, to continue with this, in Der Spiegel, this is a really interesting story in which unnamed security officials, unnamed, of course, revealed to Der Spiegel that the domestic intelligence agency in the state of Thuringia told neo-Nazi leader Tino Brandt about police surveillance of his activities. At the time, Brandt was an active informant for the intelligence agency, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution. So you see how that works? Brandt was not a neo-Nazi. He was a federal agent pretending to be a neo-Nazi. Naturally, he became a leader. The feds in these movements become the leaders of the movements. And but they pretend that he was a real neo-Nazi who decided to be an informant. Now, Brandt was, this is going on with the story, Brandt was also told that the Thuringia police had rented an apartment near his house. He was told this by the intelligence people who he was working for on the police. The intelligence, the security people told Brandt that the police were following him and watching him so that he could, shed them. Now, his contacts, they call them contacts, his contacts, that's the intelligence people, described which vehicles were being used by the police observation team. Things went so far that at one point, intelligence agents in cars were following the police observation team's cars, which were following Brandt. This is what the paper said. Now, the latest details in the case, already plagued with tales of police and intelligence errors, and this is really the spin that they put on it, come after the Daily Bild on Sunday, a Sunday paper, reported that the intelligence agency had given Brandt some 2,000 Deutschmarks to help the terrorist cell. The terrorist cell is composed of this Uwe Bonhart, Uwe Mundlos, who are both now dead, and this Beate Chepe, who is in custody. And I sent out a newsletter, a little news thing about that to my mailing list last week, and I thought it was highly interesting. Some of you have probably read it. Now, I don't know why they say Deutschmarks instead of euros, but anyway, this couldn't have been way back before they had the euro, but it's possible that that's what they're talking about, something that long ago. Supposedly, they wanted Brandt to give this money to these three people to acquire new passports. You know, they want to help them continue their activities, because this is what the security agencies who are infiltrating these groups do. So though agents also arranged a middleman to help with this process, the money never reached the trio, who are now believed to have formed a group. See, now believed. At that time, they weren't believed to have formed a group called the National Socialist Underground. But now they've decided that they have done that and were allegedly responsible for at least 10 murders over 7 years, including 9 men of Turkish and Greek origin and a police officer. They always add that. Just like when they're writing about the Holocaust, no matter what person or what latest survivor story they come up with, they always add a couple of times, the Nazis killed 6 million Jews in gas chambers, and they have to repeat that. And that's what they're doing here. They constantly are repeating that these three allegedly, you know, they have to say that, are responsible for 10 murders, blah, blah. So now going on, this was an interesting story, but today I just went to Der Spiegel before the program and I found something new that I have to quote from. And this is called Secret Report of Investigators' Failure. It's a long article, 3 parts, and you can go to Der Spiegel, Google Secret Report of Investigators' Failure, and you can read it there. But I'm going to point out a few things from that. It says the Office for the Protection of the Constitution detailed the failure of the surveillance operation in Chemnitz and other similar blunders by the Office for the Constitution. In a 30-page confidential report that was sent to the German government, the relevant committee of the German parliament, and the federal states shortly before Christmas. In the document, which Spiegel has obtained, you know, and so on they go. Now, this was a confidential report sent to the government and parliamentary committees and federal states, but somehow Spiegel has obtained it, naturally. They wanted Spiegel to obtain it so that Spiegel could put a spin on it that they wanted it to be put on it for the German people to read and the rest of us around the world. But it says that they, you know, they're focusing on the failure of the security agencies in catching these people early enough before they did these alleged murders. Now, worse still, they say, in this article, it paints the picture of a country whose security apparatus has failed. Okay, now this is me. This is the spin. Exactly what was said. This is exactly what was said after 9/11 here. If you don't have any problem, I'm sure, remembering that, that our security failed and we needed a Department of Homeland Security to make sure such mistakes are not repeated. This threats to security always seem to work, don't they? No matter how many times we go through this, when the government tells people that their security is threatened, most people tend to kind of go along with it. They need what they want. What they want to be able to do is things like hire more agents. They want to get more money. They want to, you know, increase the security, to stop this. So that's why they're playing this up. Now, here's more from the article. The office, excuse me. The Office for the Protection of the Constitution was aided by a high-level source whose identity it refused to divulge to the police. And here they come up with this same guy again, Tino Brandt, code name Otto. Isn't that cute? The head of a far-right militant group called Thuringer Heimatschutz, which translates to Thuringian Homeland Protection, which is a far-right group, which numbered up to 70 members, so they say. With his curly blonde hair and square schoolboy's glasses, Brandt looked like a harmless kid, but he had charisma and the necessary ruthlessness to not only lead the local neo-Nazi scene, but also betray it to the authorities at the same time. He knew Bonhart, Mundlos, and Chape personally. Now, you know, I'm saying, can you believe such obvious malarkey? That these agents, the agents that they put out there are real, genuine, ruthless neo-Nazis who are just somehow betraying their fellows. And because, you know, this, they know, they're implying that Nazis are such scum that they just are constantly betraying their own group members. Now, further on in the article, they say about him, though Otto, through Otto, his code name, intelligence agency officials now had a direct link to the underground, but they still didn't manage to connect the right dots. Well, there we go. More 9/11 talk. Isn't that all we heard after 9/11? Oh, our security failed. Oh, they didn't connect the dots. How did so many things fail? How did we not know what was going on? Oh, they didn't connect the right dots. And they're just copying this here. They're trying to build this little thing with these young people here, these three people, into some big terrorist plot. They've got graphs in which they show the picture of these two guys, and they have one other guy who used to be a member of the NPD but dropped out a couple years ago. And then they have Beata Chape, who sometimes they put her picture in. Everybody else is just these empty faces that they haven't figured out who these people are yet. But they're showing faces, blank faces, to make you think that there's a lot of people there involved. But the whole thing is to increase security. And in this case, they want to increase security to close down the right wing, to close down all the right wing. Now, you can read this for yourself, I said, but it's classic strategy that's been used. We've seen it used here. It's being used there. It's totally undemocratic in this idea of creating governments and situations in which there can be no dissenting parties, So more attacks. That we had in 2011. More attacks on the right in Germany came from when Thilo Sarrazin, who I talked about in a program or two, shook things up in Germany with his anti-immigration book, Germany Does Away With Itself, and lost his job with the central bank and was almost kicked out of the left-wing Social Democratic Party. But he was a man who, while he was part of this, somewhat the elite or the establishment, he still was upset and didn't like what was happening to his country because of immigration, Turkish immigration mostly. And so he wrote this book, which was a bestseller, thank goodness, and influenced a lot of people. So this was a big, good thing that happened for us in 2011. I think he wasn't even kicked out of the party, which is not too important, but he did lose his job with the bank. However, I have a little note here that there is something called a PISA study, and it's a program for international student assessment. It conducted a study which revealed that children from immigrants and workers were years behind the level of the average German pupil. It also revealed that the German school system was poor as compared with other leading industrial nations. So what was at one time an excellent school, one of the best school systems in the world in Germany, has been really brought down by having all these Turkish children being thrown into it. And, the biggest immigrant group in Germany are the Turks. And they have a lot of children. They're not the only one, but they have a lot of children. And so the schools are being filled with all these children. So they end up being a much bigger part of the school population than the Turks are a part of the general population yet. Now, another thing that happened against the right wing in Germany in 2011 happened in July. When Rudolf Hess's body was stolen from his grave in the dead of night and immediately cremated before anybody knew it had even happened. I did a program on that, and maybe part of another program. But Rudolf Hess was Adolf Hitler's second in command until he flew to England and was kidnapped there and held from then on incommunicado. But... They couldn't stop the fondness of the right-wing people for Rudolf Hess, and they would make these marches to the cemetery where he was buried with his parents and wife. And then suddenly, in the dead of night, in July, the cemetery officials dug up all the graves, the whole grave, and nothing was ever said about what happened to Hess's wife and parents' bodies. Nobody ever, there was never, that was never in any of the stories that I could see. But Hess's body was cremated, and then they were going to throw it into a lake or something, but it hadn't, but in any case, they said his granddaughter gave permission for it, but that was after she had undergone a great deal of pressure. And at first she said no, and she was trying to not do it, but they pressured her so much that she finally gave in. So I want to tell you about one of my loyal listeners from Germany who wrote to me about the architecture and sculpture program, architecture and sculpture in the Third Reich, that played last week here on Voice of Reason. And it he called it phenomenal, but he likes that kind of thing. He said, your second guest, Rodney Martin, was right. The Tempelhof Airport gets demolished. Tempelhof was originally constructed in 1927, but in anticipation of increasing air traffic, the National Socialist Government began a massive reconstruction in the mid-1930s. And so it became, it was an improved design. It was a beautiful design. It was really famous throughout the world. But it's going to be demolished. It closed down. It may be outdated, but, it's a beautiful place, but, that hasn't happened yet, but it's scheduled. And my reader continues on, my emailer says, it's going to be demolished as the gigantic Deutschland Hall recently was demolished, which was built in just 9 months for the 1936 Olympics, where even the first helicopter ever flew. Yeah, the indoors, they did an indoor demonstration. This was such a large place of a helicopter. It was Hannah Reich who carried that out. Just because it was built, he says, in that certain time, quote unquote, you know, because it's a part of the Third Reich, they think they might as well just tear it down. So he talks a little bit about it. He says, reminds us that it was heavily damaged by air bombing in 1943. I'm going to be going into that in the next hour. It was rebuilt after the war and used as a multi-purpose arena and sports venue. But I noticed from pictures that when they rebuilt it, they changed the facade. So it was a far more common looking exhibition hall than what it had been. It had a much more noble look to it originally. But my writer says, and now perhaps a greedy degenerate Jew can earn millions by placing an ugly cube where once the Deutschland Hall stood. Well, I don't have too much time left, so I've got a few things more to say. I'll just say that something else that's disappearing, according to James Sanchez, is the flesh, the color flesh for skin. He tells us this amazing story that Kinko's, his Kinko's in Seattle, but he says it's now acquired by FedEx and renamed FedEx Office, has new color photocopiers. He uses their photocopiers. He's used them in the past, and he's found something out, that their new photocopiers don't print flesh color. Instead, it washes out to pure white, but more often has a greenish or blue hue. Minor variations in flesh coloring due to lighting become bluish or greenish splotches. Features disappear. Slight shading turns into a lurid blue. So photographs of beautiful white children, like the ones in the pictures, like the ones in the pictures I have for tonight's show. I hope you noticed I have, when tonight's show goes up, on VOR, you'll see, and I had it in my announcement, the two little white children, little white babies. Like those, he says the beautiful white children become ugly and deathly and often grotesque. Happily, he says, I was assured it only happens with white skin. And then he comments, unbelievable. Well, if that's true, it really is unbelievable. because there are a lot of signs that somehow this hatred of whites is growing by leaps and bounds, and we're finding it in the most amazing places and in the most amazing ways that we wouldn't have dreamed of before. And yet now here's another listener from Canada wrote to me, a first only the second time I've heard from him, but he listened to my program with Christine Miller, which is posted at my website. He said that he's been going to a German church in Canada, and he's hearing two things: that many Germans wished they could have died during the war because it was so terrible for everyone. That's what I'm going to be talking about in the next hour. And secondly, that Jews controlled Germany, so how did the whole thing happen in the first place? Well, I can talk about that another time, but he then says, you know, as if the Jews controlled Germany, so how did the Jews get deported from Germany, I think is what he means. He says, I didn't know that there was no talk about the master race. By the way, the Germans in the church didn't even know about Jews in camps other than as rumors. This is what they're saying. He says, such as when we hear that babies are killed in abortion clinics. Oh, I want to say that he says one of the reasons that minorities are moving to white communities is that they want to intermarry.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Sandra Gutman. The Arab League Secretary General has called for an end to violence by government forces in Syria. Nabil al-Arabi's warning follows a retreat by Syrian military forces from residential areas as Arab monitors in the country observe a crackdown on activists. Members of the Arab League are set to remain in Syria until their observer mission is completed, saying it's vital they see out key points in a deal that includes the freeing of political prisoners and the removal of snipers. The Egyptian trial involving former President Hosni Mubarak is set to resume on Tuesday as prosecutors seek to prove government responsibility for the deaths of hundreds of protesters in the Tahrir uprising. Lawyers have demanded the return of Egypt's military council leader and field marshal Mohamed Hussein Tantawi to give new testimony. As one of the first leaders ousted in the Arab Spring, Hosni Mubarak's trial has garnered worldwide attention, not least because of his appearance in court in a caged bed due to an alleged heart condition. The UK Prime Minister says 2012 will be when Britain gets back on its feet. In his New Year address, David Cameron assured the coalition government is doing all it can to stabilize Britain's economy in the face of a neighboring debt crisis in the Eurozone and as Britain attempts to tackle its own budget deficit. Our UK correspondent Ollie Barrett says the new year will also be a testing ground for internal politics within the UK's coalition.
The coalition government says that the economy, that Britain is now a safe haven at the time when the Eurozone crisis continues, when countries like Greece and Italy are having troubles with their debts and the cost of paying those debts. So certainly the coalition government wants 2012 to be another year in which it remains stable and in power, particularly the opposition Labour Party, will be trying to force the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats apart on certain issues so that they can exploit those differences.
Denmark has taken over the European Union's six-month rotating presidency, kicking off what is expected to be another traumatic year for the Eurozone. Like all presidency countries, Denmark has a specific to-do list, but its most pressing task will be to keep the EU's 27 members politically united. Our Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mock has more.
Denmark is not part of the single currency, and its job over the coming half year will be to ensure that countries that use the euro do not drift apart from those that don't. In December, all 17 eurozone countries agreed to forge ahead with a new treaty to tighten fiscal discipline. 9 non-euro countries, including Denmark, pledged to eventually sign up to that pact as well. But Britain is not taking part. The new treaty is sensitive, and Denmark, along with Ireland and other countries, will struggle to sign up to it without triggering a national referendum.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A national...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. I am Carolyn Yeager, and this is our second hour, which is a call-in hour, and even though I've got plenty to talk about. I invite anyone to call who wants to call in. Well, almost anyone. has something worthwhile to say. The number is 1-855-477-2283. You're welcome to dial that number, and you will reach me. 1-855-477-2283. Now, I kind of rushed at the end of the, before the break, in discussing what this listener had emailed to me about going to the German church. And what I really wanted to mention that was that fits with what I was just talking about was that he said, and I quote from him, "One of the reasons that minorities are moving to white communities is that they want to intermarry with whites." He says, "I, as a single man, am propositioned all the time by non-white women. And I hear from the mouths of non-white men all the time that they have come to Canada to marry a white woman. They want their children to go to school with white kids. It's an obsession with much of the world." Well, he's correct, and he sounds like he's someone who is not extreme in any way, that he has not been particularly racial. You know, he's not super racialist thinking. But he's now coming to be aware of these things, and he's changing his mind about some things now, he says. So, well, all right, I'm almost to the end here. One more thing I want to say is that I would like, there's a story that came out last week. This goes back to the Holocaust again, about Thomas Johnson, a judge, and the Mel Mermelstein story. I'm not going to go into it very much, but I'll just say that this man was a Superior Court judge, or he, in Los Angeles, who recently died. And he ruled in 1981, when he wasn't actually on the Superior Court then, he was on the court lower, that the Holocaust was a fact. By using the doctrine of judicial notice that recognizes certain facts as common knowledge, that we're familiar with this from Germany. But he did that here in 1981, and this was a very important case between the Institute of Historical Review, and Mel Mermelstein was suing the Institute for Historical Review for some millions of dollars because they had advertised that anybody that could prove that the gas chambers, people died in gas chambers, that something like that, they would win like $50,000, and he came along with some saying that when he was there at Auschwitz and he saw his mother and sister or something walk away, and he never saw them again, and he knows they went to the gas chamber and so on. That's all he had, but this judge said that his decision, he found in favor of Mermelstein, that he should have won that $50,000, and against the IHR, because he said his decision was not based on Mermelstein's declarations as a Holocaust survivor, because his declarations had no proof in them whatsoever. But his decision was based on, quote, sources of reasonably indisputable fact, including many books. You know, so this judge just decided that he saw that there were a lot of books about it, and they must be right. So Mermelstein won a settlement of $90,000 from the Institute of Historical Review, which at that time belonged to Willis Carto, and that was something of a disaster for Willis Carto and the IHR, and that was probably the beginning of the difficulties that were had when eventually Willis Carto, the Institute, was taken away from Willis Carto through a lot of stuff that I won't go into. That's a whole other story. But, you know, this shows what happened in 1981 in Los Angeles, California. And I don't think it could happen today. I'm quite sure that a judge would not get away with that kind of stuff. But there was nobody much around to say too much. I think that we have made advances in Holocaust revision, in exposing the Holocaust as a hoax. People say that it hasn't made any progress, but that's not true. We really have made a lot of progress. It's just that there is such an established base of establishment is so solid, but they can't do the things they used to do with nonchalance and nobody going up against them. So we're getting there, and this is one of the themes that I will continue with, and many people need to continue with it, and many people need to keep supporting it, because we're making a lot of headway, and this is one of the basic pillars of what our problems are, that this Holocaust legend continues to be believed by so many. Now, I was talking about this book, The Fire. I've had this book for a couple of years, and I finally decided I was going to read it. And I was going to read it over Christmas holiday. Such a depressing book to read over Christmas holiday. But I have read maybe almost half of it now, but I haven't finished it. But it's not easy. It's not easy reading. It's like a hard slog to go page after page, and I'm reading it all of this terrible, terrible facts and figures and so on of what happened, the book is subtitled The Bombing of Germany, 1940 to 1945. And as I said, it's by Jörg Friedrich. He has it divided into chapters. The first chapter, which I'm going to read from tonight, is called Weapon. And it's quite long. It has quite a few parts to it. But it goes into a lot of detail about the planes, the bombs, how they developed from explosive bombs to incendiary bombs, and how they perfected their fire raising, that they called it, which could start fires that would somehow merge together and create firestorms, which were of a nature that was just as bad, if not even worse. I don't know if it could be worse, but just as bad as an atomic bomb. You know, when we talk about the bombing of World War II, if you mention the bombing of Germany, somebody will right away say, they dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese. As though that eclipses everything else that was done, and that's what we should focus, you know, talk about. Actually, they bombed Tokyo in the same way that they bombed the German cities, with creating firestorms and stuff. And it killed more people. Of course, that's because Tokyo is larger, than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it was just as bad. And so the bombing of Germany gets kind of short shrift. Nobody wants to focus on it. Even the Germans refuse to do it. But this man wrote this book. Well, where is that copyright? I can't find it. Anyway, it's fairly new. You know, it was in 2000-something, a few years ago, came out. And he has gone through every detail. I mean, he covers it in the greatest detail, and it's really something. So what I'm going to read from tonight for you, and I hope you will find it interesting. It's not going to be very nice, but I'm going to read not the technical parts about the bombs and the, you know, the scientists working on all of this stuff and the how they worked it out and so on. I'm going to read the section towards the beginning where, in the only place I found so far in the book where he doesn't, where he talks in terms of the, he has witness people talking who remembered it, who survived. Some survivor testimony would have to be. To give an idea of what it was like for an individual person on the ground, because, you know, we get in terms of these numbers of hundreds and thousands of deaths and the tremendous damage that took place, just out unbelievable. You know, I used to hear people, I would hear this, the phrase, well, the entire country of Germany was bombed out. And I thought that was just kind of a manner of speaking, because it couldn't possibly be, because it's all there now. But it's been rebuilt. And, you know, when they bomb these great historic structures that are from, you know, 900 and 1,000 and 1,200 and that were begun in those times and then added on to and that are, you know, very old and were built at the time when they were building in that manner, when they destroy those, which they did by just about all of it, except in a couple of places, and then they have rebuilt them. You know, they've managed to copy what they looked like and so on. And we think, well, there it is, still there. You know, it's back. There it is. But it's not, because it's a copy. It's a replica. It's not the original from that time, way back when. So this was people and cultural treasures, of incredible amount of cultural treasures that were destroyed in a most barbarous way by people who you can only call barbarians. You know, the British and the Americans just became barbarians, and they got worse and worse as the in 44 and 45. I'm going to be reading parts of this book for as long as I need to, you know, while I talk about other things too on this program. So I'm just going to start here tonight with on page 4, and I've got some parts selected, and I'll try not to make any commentary so that you know that what I'm reading is just from the book. Okay, this is after he's gotten into it a bit. We're talking about the town of Wuppertal. Wuppertal, I might be pronouncing it wrong. It's a kind of a nice name. And also the town of Barmen. They were next to each other. And Wuppertal is west of Dusseldorf and northwest of Cologne. So it's in the western part of Germany, kind of middle to northern, not really far north. And the town, the planes came, and quite a lot of them. It says 300,000 bombs fell that night. It came at May evening in 1943. So we're talking about spring 1943, not that far into this. So this is one of the first of the really serious, terrible bombing experiences for the Germans. And I don't have here how many planes there were, but there would have been quite a lot of planes. And they come in waves. But anyway, we'll hear about that. And they missed where they were supposed to go, and they ended up bombing Barmen. But then they came back and bombed Wuppertal, too. So here I'm going to start quoting. The people were in their shelters, you know, while this was going on. And it says, hidden in another cellar, Sybil Bannister, an Englishwoman, trusting in the vaulting of German ceilings, which were, as she put it, strong as a church crypt, that's in quotes, her friend had quickly gone upstairs to grab her jacket from the ground floor and saw that the stairwell was in flames from top to bottom. We couldn't, quote, we couldn't fathom how the fire could spread so quickly through the four-story building, even if 100 fire bombs had penetrated the attic, unquote. If the stairwell collapsed, said the air raid warden, then burning rubble would fall onto the cellar steps and everyone would die from the heat and smoke. He led the women through the small opening in the wall into the cellar next door. Quote, it was pitch black and the hole was very small. I was horrified at the thought of getting closed into this dreadfully narrow passageway, unquote. Two girls dared to cross the yard to climb over the wall, but the wall was gone. Since flames were coming from all directions, they ran into the swimming center across the street. Flames shot out of the building, but there was nowhere else to go. 20 people were trapped inside. In order to escape the intense heat, they kept jumping into the pool and wrapping wet clothing around their heads and bodies. The natatorium was burning down all around them. The ceramic tiles were as hot as an oven. Surrounded by fire, many sought protection in the Wupper River, in the Wupper River. They did not jump in, but instead slid down the embankment walls. Elizabeth Stark, a physician on duty in the first aid center, was called in by firefighters and let down on rope ladders to help the burn victims out of the water. Quote, half their bodies were one giant wound with shreds of clothing sticking to it, unquote. Dr. Stark treated the wounds and gave morphine injections to ease the pain. Louise Rumpf crawled with her family through the laundry room of the neighboring cellar. Quote, the laundry room was filled with a chaotic babble of sobbing, praying, and loud scolding. The mother of a baby girl only a few months old was holding a wet cloth over her daughter's face to help her get some air. I did that with Uli, too. The caustic smoke made it harder and harder to breathe. You need to understand that this Uli is Louise Rumpf's son. Continuing, even though the ceiling held up in the public air raid shelters under the burning factory on Adolf Hitlerstrasse, Ruth Adamson worried about the air. Quote, I didn't feel very safe anymore, so I convinced my mother and aunt to try to find shelter elsewhere. Luckily, the street was very wide, unquote. Hot ashes and sparks flew around above them. The flames shot out of windows on both sides of the street and joined together, quote, like a tall cathedral, unquote. 24-year-old Ruth held her aunt Lene's arm, and her mother ran beside her with her eyes closed. Quote, when we got to Erichstrasse, we heard horrific screams coming out of the fire. Help me, I'm burning. Later, I found out it was Herr Doring, who used to sell my notebooks for school, unquote. The smoke in the laundry room forced the Rumpf family to leave. They opened up the bricked-up hole leading to the third cellar, since it was getting too crowded for all the residents from three buildings. Everyone, quote, everyone was silent and listened to what was going on outside. The sky was quiet now. We heard only the crackling and seething of the columns of fire around us that were surging up to the sky, quote, unquote. I mean, the planes were gone. The people climbed out of the cellars and, quote, stared in bewilderment into the sky, where yellow, red, and gray cloud formations were billowing, unquote. Confused children with small bags stood around dumbly. People ran past, quote, with distorted or empty expressions, some with the dulled looks on their faces, unquote. The 11 families, well, there was a wedding party. The 11 families from the wedding party hurried out of the shelter. And seven of them had nothing left. I'm not going to read that part. Mrs. Bannister, who climbed out into the open where the bombardment stopped, realized that through the help, that though the airplanes had gone, the attack had just begun. And this is a longer quote. As far as we could see, every single building was on fire. I tried to walk in the middle of the street because flames were licking out of every window, and the trees at the edge of the sidewalk were also burning and throwing down their glowing branches. The heated and softened tarmac on the streets made it difficult to walk. That's the end of that quote. As they ran out to the street from their cellars, people often got stuck in the melted asphalt, making it hard to avoid the burning debris raining down all around them. Old wooden buildings started to topple. The smoke got denser and the path narrower. Quote, now the way back was blocked and the fire had surrounded me. This is Mrs. Bannister. I looked for a place where the flames didn't reach it all that high, only about to my knees, unquote. Mrs. Bannister ignored the burns on her legs and the caustic smoke in her eyes, mouth, and throat that was starting to suffocate her. Quote, I was just overcome by a growing dreadful drowsiness, unquote. No oxygen was reaching her brain. She thought to herself this might be the end of both her and the child in her arms. Quote, when my knees gave out, I couldn't hold Manny anymore. And he rolled out of my arms. He was lying there, still wrapped in the blanket, with only his legs poking out. Whenever the flames touched them, he screamed with pain and rolled and thrashed about on the ground in front of me, unquote. It was his screaming that stirred her deadened senses. A patrolling rescue vehicle picked up the two of them and took them to police headquarters, where injured people blackened with soot were being sent to receive medical care. Quote, the rescue operation seemed very well organized, unquote. Mrs. Bannister suffered burned calves, and she was given a bandage soaked in some liquid to prevent the chemicals from burning deeper into the flesh. On her way, she noticed the clear-cut edge of the destruction. Quote, on one side of the line was hell, and on the other side was a normal city. Though the air was full of smoke and there was unusual bustling in the middle of the night, the buildings were still standing. It was truly precision work, unquote. When the bombers returned 4 weeks later, they started at the edge of Wuppertal Barmen and destroyed Wuppertal Elberfeld. Okay, still going. A foul smell of gas, fire, and earth permeated the city. The smoke obscured the sun. An orange-colored sky hung over the valley. About 300 yards from Dr. Stark's first aid center was the Fisher Tall Hospital. Inside, 30 mothers and their newborns had been incinerated. Dark gray smoke poured out of the houses in the valley as Louise Rumpf crossed the fields. At the center of these buildings was the burning obstetrics clinic with a big red cross marked on the roof, unquote. Some patients had managed to get out. Quote, I saw women from the clinic lying all over the meadows, sick women, pregnant women, women giving birth, unquote. Nurses ran back and forth spreading out blankets. Between the groans and screams were the pleasant sounds of newborn babies crying. 9-year-old Wilfred Pickard, I'm going to skip that part. I'm going to turn to here. Some commentary here by the author. The May 1943 Wuppertal operation was regarded in England as the most successful mission thus far. Quote, no industrial city in Germany, wrote the Times, has ever before been so completely wiped off the map, unquote. More than 10% of the aircraft had missed the city and bombed Remscheid and Solingen to the south. But the other 500 planes, okay, so we've got 550 more planes. Had hit within a 3-mile radius of the target. It took weeks to recover all the bodies. 80% of the residential land area was destroyed, and 3,400 people were killed. That was 5 times the previous record set with the same bomb tonnage, which was 693 deaths, which had been set shortly earlier in Dortmund. 4 other cities suffered more than 200 civilian deaths in 1943. Munich lost 208 people on the night of March 9th. Duisburg lost 272 in the early morning hours of May 13th. Essen lost 461 on March 6th. and Stuttgart lost 619 on April 15th. News spread quickly about the disaster in Wuppertal. The estimated number of deaths ranged from 4,000 to 40,000. Well, some of that was exaggerated, you know, when it first happens. But it says there were no reliable reports in the media, but people sensed that the air war had taken on a new form, fire. People had previously assumed that sooner or later in the war, gas would be dropped. As it turned out, a different chemistry was used. The shift from explosive bombing to the incendiary fire war was interpreted by observers on the ground as a phosphorus rain, which was a trivial error because the sparkling cascades of the flares and markers, which were described earlier in the book, were confused with the incendiary material, a mixture in which phosphorus was added as an ignition source. Well, we're almost to our break. I want to remind people, I will continue with this after the break, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I still have listeners. I want to remind you that you are still free to call in if you want to. It's 1-855-477-2283. And I think that this information is so important to get strongly into our minds, because for me it is the ones that I find most at fault, which I'm probably wrong about that, but is the Americans. Because as we go on, we will find that in 1945, the Americans really took over and did some of the most incredible destructive bombing that is imaginable, even though the British started it. So thank you for sticking with me so far, and I'll be back after this news break for more. This is Carol.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Iran has been holding these military exercises, as we say, for the past 10 days and threatening to close a key oil route. Does it only have itself to blame, though, for latest sanctions?
Not at all. I mean, even if you look at what the U.S. presidential candidate Ron Paul has been saying, he says that the sanctions on the Iranian central bank by the American government is effectively an act of war. So it is really the Americans that are being provocative. They are trying to make ordinary Iranians suffer. At the same time, you see senior American officials and politicians constantly calling for the assassination of Iranian scientists, of Iranian military commanders, of politicians, and the constant threat of attacking and bombing the country. So really the problem lies with the United States. The maneuvers in the Persian Gulf are basically to show the United States that Iran is strong and can protect itself, and it is basically the only way in which to force the United States to recognize that certain lines just simply shouldn't be crossed.
Okay, we see these maneuvers, but practically speaking, does Iran actually have the ability to carry out any threat of closing the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, remember, just like an ordinary human being, if you try to make it a human being suffocate, that there will be a severe response. If the Americans and its allies try to make the Iranian economy suffocate, the Iranians will have no option but to respond in a severe manner. And the Iranians are far stronger than the Americans would like to admit. Just recently, they brought down and captured the most sophisticated drone in the U.S. military. The Iranians have blinded a CIA satellite. And if you recall in the 2006 war, the Israelis made the very same miscalculation. They attacked Lebanon thinking that it would be a walkover, but they were soundly defeated by Hezbollah. So the only difference, though, here is that this is a region where an extraordinarily large amount of oil and gas goes through. And if there is insecurity in the region, it's not just the Strait of Hormuz. If there is a conflict in the Persian Gulf, tankers will be at risk, oil installations will be at risk. War is hell. So it's not at all just the Strait of Hormuz. And this instability will go beyond the Persian Gulf. It will, I think, oil exports and gas exports will be at risk in Central Asia and throughout the Middle East. And there will be a lot of backlash from the public throughout the region.
So given what you say then, is a real war in the region possible?
I personally think that it is doubtful.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We have got 25 more minutes to go. I have been reading from the book The Fire, The Bombing of Germany, 1940-1945 by Jörg Friedrich. And we have a caller now, Frank from Pittsburgh. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I just wanted to point one thing out, too. Pat Buchanan, in his book, Death of the West, also details a lot of what you have said. The Second World War and what the Allies did to Germany and really to a lot of the Western European countries, we ended up with a decimated continent, and at the conclusion we had communism take over all of Eastern Europe, and I think it sort of speaks volumes to the way the United States managed the Second World War, and really speaks to the true intent, I think, of the Roosevelt administration as well as Churchill. I mean, when you talk with some of that generation of people that are still around, they still think that those people walk on water. But I think as time goes on, we really see how kind of diabolical the whole thing was. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, Frank, hold on a minute. That's a very good comment you made. Are you still there? No, I guess he hung up. Well, that's a very good comment from Frank. You know, I think that the more I have looked into this, the more I come to the conclusion that the United States is one of the most evil, the most detrimental nations that have ever existed on the planet. You know, maybe that's wrong. I'm thinking in terms of the Western world. I just can't think of much good that the United States does things. And I wanted to ask Frank about how he thought the Roosevelt administration, how much they were influenced by Jewry in all of this, or if this is just something that's kind of Americana too. That's something that we can talk about at a later time, or maybe somebody else will call about it. So I'm going to continue reading here on page 9. Since the beginning of 1943, researchers at Britain's Air Ministry were working diligently to develop the annihilating potential of fire. The damage caused by explosive bombs, which are laborious to transport, did little to impress the enemy. Light fuels could be loaded in virtually unlimited quantities, and provided they hit their targets, gave rise to a multiplicative evil that could be far more destructive. Frank is back. Okay. Hi, Frank.
Well, hi. Yeah, I didn't mean to step out. Yeah, I get your question.
Did you?
Yeah, how I felt.
How that administration was functioning from 1933 on, and you're right that the whole war, World War II, was so totally destructive and destroying of our values and our entire system. So, you know, how do we look at, in your opinion, how do we look at the part that America played in the Roosevelt administration?
Well, I think as time goes on, for people that are a little more cerebral, that look a little deeper in this, they really can see the improprieties of the Roosevelt administration. They've always very conveniently left out their antagonizing policies toward Japan to try to induce Japan to really come into war against them, because they were aware mm-hmm. of the relationship with Japan and Italy and Germany. The other thing, too, that's never pointed out is that Hitler made a speech called How Wars Are Made, and I would love to see it translated in English and put on the Internet. And in the United States, when Hitler made the speech, it was misrepresented to the American people. A lot mm-hmm. of the speech were left out.
Yeah.
He pointed out how Germany had never had any colonial ambitions, never any kind of imperialistic principles such as the United States and Great Britain had had, and that the United States really was involving themselves in the European war, and they really had no place there.
Absolutely. Absolutely, but then that was that's where the tie-in with Britain. I mean, Britain only continued to be an antagonistic toward Germany, refused all these wonderful, very excellent peace offers that Hitler was making to end this conflict. He refused them because he had the promise of Roosevelt that he would win over the American people and he would get into the war, and that Churchill should hang on until he got in there, because he wanted to get in there, and he finally did it, and then that's how the whole thing worked out. But Roosevelt is probably and America is probably the biggest the most responsible party, the most guilty party of all.
And the thing about Roosevelt too is, you know, most of the people that realize that Roosevelt was an East Coast elitist. He was a war profiteer from the First World War. I mean, he was anything but a friend to the working masses. And when I hear people talk about these fireside chats and how inspiring they were, I want to vomit. There is nothing redeemable about FDR. The truth of the matter is, even a lot of his economic policies with the bank holiday and all that, that was pulled right out of the book of Herbert Hoover. Hoover had a lot of those same things lined up. When the country went into a recession, or went into the Depression, Hoover had a lot of trouble getting things through the House and the Senate. Roosevelt gets all these accolades for getting the country through the Depression. My God, we got through the Depression in spite of him, not because of anything he did. He was a degenerate. I mean, when you look into his personal life, even as kind as authors and as historians try to be, he was a very flawed individual.
He
was one of those people that he spoke with a very eloquent tone in his voice, and he used some, you know.
Well, that's who they give us. There are people who think that Barack Obama is eloquent. I don't think so. He doesn't sound even intelligent to me, but people say, he can win people over. That's what they choose. That's how it's done, and we really need to wise up to this. You know, Hitler had a heart for people. He had a heart for people, but Churchill and Roosevelt, neither one of them had any feeling for people whatsoever.
they were really the early 20th century parts of the globalist movement. Mm-hmm. Say what you will about Hitler, and you know, the thing about Adolf Hitler, he was for the German people. Maybe there were some mistakes that happened along the way, but make no mistake, he had no other alternative.
Well, he didn't have too many alternatives, no, in order to bring Germany back to a state of independence and strength. That's what he wanted to do. Not supremacy, but, you know, he thought Germans were major race in Europe, and they should be accorded that, and they should have that kind of influence, and they should, and it was all about German pride and so on, following World War One in the aftermath. So, you know, that was his goal, to do that, and that's what he was doing. It was nothing so evil about it at all.
No, he was trying to get back territory that was lost Treaty of Versailles. People had been misled into believing that Hitler went on some ravaging war, declaring war. I mean, people forget the fact that it was Great Britain and France that declared war on Germany. And the other side of the coin is when Germany invaded Poland, they didn't invade Poland to take the whole country. They wanted to take some of their territory back that was along the Polish border. What ended up turning into the major war was when the Soviet Union attacked Poland on the other side. Hitler, I mean, it was always very conveniently left out of all the dialogue. When people talked about fear of communism, they always left the Jewish element out of it. People that didn't really understand European history in the 20s and 30s, communism was a plague, and Germany was trying to keep communism out of their country. And Hitler basically made the connection between the two, although, again, U.S. media and Great Britain, they presented Hitler as some crazy who just...
And, you know, they didn't do it until they had decided that the things were right to go to war and they wanted a world war. They didn't do it until then. They weren't talking that badly about Hitler until 1938. But if Poland had worked out the territorial things that Hitler wanted, and Hitler was being very agreeable to them in order to just get the Danzig problem solved and the problem with the Silesia and the way they were persecuting the Germans there. He wanted to solve that. If they had done that, Hitler would not have made that agreement with that treaty with the Soviet Union, and that none of that would have happened to Poland. And they won't admit that. Nobody will admit it. But anyway, that is the truth, and people like Buchanan can have written about that, and other revisionist historians. But
the BBC even did a special a few years ago, and it followed up with a printed version on the internet. Hitler at one point was starting to disarm. He was starting to disarm his military after the war with France. France, it wasn't that the French were weak people or they didn't want a war. I actually think that the French weren't really too at odds with Hitler's view on things. Certainly, I'm convinced the First World War kind of made the French war weary about long entanglement and something else. But the Second World War has been...
Well, but, you know, but that de Laudier, is it, who at Versailles... He was the worst of all in demanding the most impossible reparations and punishment for the Germans. I mean, the French minister, he was the worst one of all. But that doesn't mean that all the French people or all the French officials felt that way. But he managed to push through the worst stuff. And even the British weren't pushing for that stuff. But this French guy was. So it's all quite a mixed bag, but it was finally decided that they wanted a world war and to destroy To me, it goes back to you mentioned the globe. They were the Roosevelt and Churchill were the first early globalists. It goes back to this idea that I brought out in the first hour that this destruction of right wing thinking is a major component of what they want to do, and it's they're carrying it out step by step, you know, to finally end all right wing, so that everything is just communistic type one worldism.
Right? Yeah, you hit it right on the head. And you can even see that what's happening right now in the country. It's just an absolute extension on a much, much bigger scale now. I mean, you can see economically, I mean, we have these different zones. We have a Eurozone. We have an African Union. All of this circulating around the economy and the printing of money and currency exchange. And immigration just, you know, the thing is with what's happened in Western Europe with all of these Turks and other countries emptying into these once white nations, that this isn't just by chance. This is being orchestrated.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The thing is, when I looked at FDR and his wife, and they were so much at the front of what was, this might be a bad choice of words, but the 1930s civil rights movement or the 1940s civil rights movement about, in essence, displacing whites or having whites being sort of mixed in with minorities and, in essence, subordinating a lot of their positions. It started there. I mean.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's hard to say where it started. But I say that what I'm trying to get across is that I feel it's so important. That's why I'm going to go through this book, to understand just what these people are capable of. You know, they want to make out that Nazis did the most horrible atrocities imaginable, and that's what we need to get rid of in the world. And that is so wrong. These people are the ones who did all the atrocities. And they're trying to blame it on to the right and nationalists and so on, and nationalism. It's all a political game. And as I pointed out, what's going on, like the way they carried out, the way they did the aftermath of 9/11, just like they're doing now with this Zwickau terror cell in Germany, trying to push the idea that we've got all these this terrorism, we need extra security. Our security failed. We didn't connect the dots. Now we need, you know, we need the Department of Homeland Security, and in Germany they need to puff up their state security, which is already extremely overdone. This is the game that they're playing, and we need to see who these people are. It's not just Jews, and if we just talk about Jews, well, the Jews are certainly in there. And of course, as somebody pointed out to me recently, this past week, Britain, the British people, the British elites and royalty and so on are so intermixed with Jewish blood, from going way back. And I believe that's true. And then you have somebody like Roosevelt. He was too. And who knows about these other presidents and leaders we've had and we have. I mean, so I'm not trying to absolve that. But, you know, they're all you can't tell who's who. You know, they're part of this. But I don't like talking about the Illuminati. I don't like talking about Satanism or any of that stuff, because I think it's just it is. And it's wrong. And I think it's done by people who really want to lead us astray. We can see what's happening directly. We don't need to go into reading all these books and history about how these things developed. You know, we see who's right and who's wrong right now in front of our eyes.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, when you listen to Newt Gingrich in a Republican debate talk about setting up teams of assassins to go over and assassinate Iranian scientists,
yeah.
Okay, again, that's just when you talk about a country that's really lost its moral compass. It's the United States.
It is.
And the bottom line is these things have a funny way of playing themselves out. The United States now, it appears to be sort of a has-been power from another century. We've got all of these people running around serving these globalists, all of them paid off by an element in the government that's just really predisposed to destroying any form of nationalism or any form of national identity any place. They want to turn the whole world into...
Well, that's it. You know, we can say, well, the United States is getting what it deserves, but then we as the white race are caught here in a very bad situation when the countries that have been our countries are falling apart and becoming total multiracialist places, and in which like with this flesh color in the Kinko's copiers. I mean, my gosh, you know, these strange things are happening where we're just being wiped away. And so I think we need to encourage our people to see that we need to rethink who we are and what is to our benefit and what is not to our benefit. And just to say, well, we're Americans or whatever. America is just the most corrupt place imaginable. And it doesn't represent me.
No, it doesn't represent. I don't think it represents what were Americans maybe 70 years ago. I mean, this country doesn't represent.
The enemies of America, whether past enemies like National Socialist Germany or present enemies like Iran or whatever, these enemies are the better people.
Oh yeah, without question. I mean, people are so misinformed in this country. I mean, Michael Schroeder, who headed up Bush's Bin Laden unit, he speaks openly about this. I mean, and he's the biggest pariah. I mean, the media doesn't like him. They've tried to talk him down, but he makes perfect sense when he talks about what's gone on. And when you even look a little bit deeper, Ron Paul touches on it, and even to a lesser extent, I've heard Jimmy Carter talk about it. The meddling that the United States has engaged in these other countries in South America and the Mideast, they've provoked all of this problem. And this isn't the United States by no means is a bastion of morality. Right now it's a co-country. It's the United States in Israel. I'm not trying to talk negatively about all Jewish people, but you know, the fact is the Jewish element, they've taken the country over, and now they're using the United States like a hijack.
They've taken the country over. They run the country, and look at the shape we're in. You can't get away from that. Wherever they take over, look at the shape. They took over Germany or close to it, and look at the shape they were in back then. I mean, they're starting to do it again. You know, they're trying to do it again. They've taken over Britain, and look at the shape they're in. I mean, this is there's no way around that. But I think this is why, and I'm going to close with this kind of talk here, we need to look at race, and I think we need to have a religion. We have to identify with a religion that fits our race, and rather than right now the countries that we live in, because they're all taken over by these globalists. Every government all over Europe, Australia, Canada, the United States, every government is all taken over by globalists and Jewish supremacist influence. So we have to think in terms of race, and heck with the idea of being called a racist. How do you feel about that, Frank? Does that keep you from talking about race and saying I'm for the white race or whatever, or however you want to say it? Go ahead.
It used to at one time. I'm not all that young anymore, and I I'm tired of being an apologist, and I don't anymore. I mean, and in recent times, I've gotten into some sort of uncomfortable set of circumstances, but I'm unapologetic about it. That something is terribly wrong. This isn't the country I remember. And the fact that we have these wars going that are, in essence, killing off our young, our sons and our daughters are going over there. And these are all wars for Israel. And again, you have the United States is.
There are wars for all the profiteers. Yeah, the United States. I think it's always been in the business of war. It's always been a very warlike place. I want to mention here before time is up that this is something that Bruce Campbell gets very passionate about. I disagree with Bruce on his Christian bashing. I think that's a big mistake. But he has a couple new articles on his website. I was thinking about discussing them a little bit tonight, but I didn't get to it. But I want to say that he's got two new articles I think people should read. It's first one is American Communism, which he wrote on the 22nd of December or was posted then. And the other one, Time to Destroy the CFR, his most recent that I saw, December 30th. And he is J.B. Campbell, extremismonline.com. Like I say, I've had concerns about Bruce Campbell, for various reasons, that kind of shift and change around, come and go. But, he sure puts down some good things, on paper. And these two, I think, are really good and I would recommend people to read them. You know, I had him as my guest, 2 weeks ago and it was a little controversial, but anyway, I think that, when I, you know, people will say, well, it's white people who have done all this murdering and created all these wars and so on. And yet, it's not all white people. It's these whites who all seem to have Jewish blood in them. But that's another thing. Okay. Show is over. Thank you, Frank. Thank you, everyone. And I hope you will come.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.